again.
You're listening to Industrial Evolution. I'm your host, Chad Perry, CTO and software engineer. You can find more episodes and contact information on our website, industrial.fm. Enjoy the show, and if you need help with custom software, data integrations, or strategy, be sure to reach out. That's industrial.fm. In this episode, we're speaking with Rick Hall, CEO of Agenity, a California-based cloud provider of analytics software whose mission is to reinvent the process of accessing and analyzing data that has traditionally been stuck in massive centralized silos. Agenity's success is proof positive that a major shift is happening at this very moment, where data is moving from central warehouses out to the edge of organizations, where decisions must be made quickly without waiting for engineers and IT teams to deliver perfectly crafted data models. And the businesses that embrace this trend will be the winners, which we're seeing now as they empower their analysts with the tools and independence to supplement centralized models, having the freedom to access and ingest their own variations of data and common business models. So Rick is here to share with us more about the emergence of what he calls collaborative analytics and what you can do to make sure that you are staying competitive. Rick, great to have you with us.
Yeah, Chad, thank you very much for the invitation.
You have a long history of leadership in technology and more specifically analytics. So if you don't mind, I think it's worth exploring how you got here in the first place.
As you say, Chad, I've been around a long time, so I'll try to kind of keep it short. So I started working in nonprofits and kind of membership type functions, really at the embrace of how do you build membership systems. And I got really kind of interested in analysis of what makes a good member, and that got me interested in analytics. And I went from there to a consulting firm, which happened to be in the early days of data warehousing. I was fortunate enough to be with that firm. We sold it in kind of the dot-com era. I ended up founding another company, which is called G4 Analytics, where we were building a generic analytical application focused on retail and consumer goods. We sold that company to Nielsen. I ran their global pricing practice there. But I kept finding that whatever we did in these centralized systems, there was always somebody out in the business who was modifying our results and doing something else with it. And, you know, I spent a lot of years looking at that going, hey, these people are, you know, really violating our core models. And right, it took me a long time to realize that, in fact, they were actually just really trying to satisfy the needs of the business. And that really took me to down this vision, down this path that brought me to this discussion of collaborative analytics. So how do we bring those people together with our core internal resources? And that led to the formation of Caron Corporation, which is the parent company that I led to purchase Agenity a year ago.
I know that you didn't start Agenity, but you've described yourself as being interested in how analytics get out to the edge of a business. So that doesn't just apply to Agenity. That's a fundamental challenge in a business. What exactly is that problem that you see? Can you go into a little bit more detail about that and maybe more about what is this concept called collaborative analytics?
You know, so you actually said it, I think, pretty well, Chad, in the introduction. We have this need that's now kind of everywhere. So I define analytics as the use of data to drive outcomes. And defined that way, it's really broad, right? It means artificial intelligence and machine learning, and it means reporting and dashboards, and it means data used in an operational way or data coming from an IoT device, et cetera, right? And when you think of it like that, you think analytics is pretty much needed in every single business process, right? And when that's the case, you start to realize, well, there's no way a centralized team is ever going to build all of the capabilities that every team in the business needs. And even if they could never build it fast enough in this world of change, right? So, and the reality is that that's been true for years, right? This is the reason why Excel is really, in reality, the most popular analytics tool on the planet, is because individuals in the business have had to do things. There's a tool that's personal, desktop oriented, that they could use to get the job done. So they've had this whole layer of independent user-driven activity that has been outside of IT. And collaborative analytics is recognizing that we have to empower those people, and we have to empower them in a way that we can bring them together with our core resources, with the large-scale data platforms that we have, with the advanced AI and modeling that we have, with the ability to ingest the kind of volumes of data that come from IoT devices, et cetera, that we don't want to treat these two worlds as different worlds, right? We'll never succeed in business if we do. So collaborative analytics is about bringing these two groups together.
Why now? As you said, Excel has been around for a long time. Excel has been solving these problems. It's almost like we're kind of reaching this breaking point where we've got so much data now, and we've got these other things that I want to talk about, which is people at every level of the organization, regardless of their role, are having to become more digitally competent.
One of the reasons is the volumes of data, right? So we're just, you know, data is exploding. And as data is exploding, we're recognizing its value is all over the place, right? So, you know, almost everybody can use data. The other thing is this really interesting change in technology, right? So when we developed these centralized systems, we went out and bought fixed capacity of servers, right? You know, buy a big server. And when we buy that server, we buy it to process a certain workload, right? And if people came along with new workloads, well, if we didn't purchase the server with that workload in mind, we had to tell them to go out on their own, right? It's like, no, you can't do that in the data warehouse, which basically meant Excel or something like it, right? And so it's out on the edge and, you know, hundreds of different versions of the truth, et cetera, et cetera. All the downside that comes with it. But hey, business people need to answer questions. They need answers now. So they're going to do what they need to do, regardless of whether it's perfect or not. But the advancements in the technology, now we have in the cloud, we have these super scalable, highly elastic platforms where we can add capacity on demand, literally scale it up and down within minutes or seconds to meet a specific workload. So the platform is no longer constrained. The amount of data has exploded. The need for using that data exists everywhere in the business. So those trends kind of have come together to say, well, now's the time to really rethink this corporate data warehouse model in a much more collaborative way.
Yeah, that's a story that we hear over and over in association with digital transformation, going digital, Industry 4.0, is that technology capabilities are driving the ability of the business to do new things. And it's not just that there's now this bleeding edge technology that you can use to do this one-off thing. It's that the whole system, the whole ecosystem, it's now reached this wholesale maturity where businesses have to rethink how they operate. Is that kind of how you see it as well?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, what's interesting is there's been this explosion of thinking around product, right, over the past 15 years. And the kind of idea of product is you want a small autonomous team, you want them to be focused on an outcome, a business outcome. You want that team to be cross-functional in nature. You want them to be empowered so they can iterate quickly, right? And all of those things have you pushing these capabilities out to these teams, right? So we have customers, you know, one of our largest customers is Amazon, which is the biggest and some say the most successful analytic company on the planet, or certainly they're out there, right? There is no central analytics group, right? They have all kinds of separate autonomous teams. Now, that proved a really interesting challenge for us in selling to them because, in fact, there was no central group to buy our stuff, right? But it turns out they put our products in their internal IT store, and these teams would go out and buy individual groups, right? So it's not about how they purchase with our software. It's interesting. The interesting thing is one of the most successful analytic companies on the planet has no central analytics team. That's, I think, the key takeaway from there. They have a bunch of autonomous teams. Every team has to be an analytics team as part of delivering some outcome.
You actually said this in our introductory call, is that industrial analytics can never scale to the variation that's going on out at the edge. Why not? I mean, really, what is the problem with having a centralized model? Why is it that you can't have a team or multiple teams? Why can't you just scale up those teams?
So look, I think there is a role for a central organization, but I think it's cross-functional and it's pushing the resources out into the business teams, right? So I tend to think of this kind of agile at scale model where the teams that are all focused on outcomes are called the product teams, and they're cross-functional and they include analytics folks. But then you have, think of them as tribes that are, you know, horizontal, and they're people of like skills and capabilities, or who are setting standards. So why do we need to work this way? Well, let's take the example of COVID, right? If you were a large consumer goods company a year ago, you know, you were selling your product through retailers, and you probably had a pretty sophisticated analytical approach, because the fact is to get the right product on the right shelf at the right price every day, actually, that's actually a hard problem. And you do that based on history, right? Well, COVID comes along and everything changes, right? So your history is kind of out the window and you start thinking about things. Well, is test positivity rate a factor? Is a factor in which retailers are adopting in-store pickup and how are they addressing it, et cetera, et cetera? All this change is happening all at once, right? And, you know, if you did, you're the head of sales and you go to your central analytics team and you say, hey, I need to address test positivity for this group over here. I need to address local pickup for this group over here, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, a couple of things happen, right? One is the central team will look at you like you have three heads, right? And the second is they say, yeah, we'll absolutely support that. We need a lot of people. And by the way, we'll be back to you and answer in 6 months. And you're like, well, I got to stock the stores next week, right? Or tomorrow, right? And, you know, I can't wait 6 months. So if we can't find a way to empower these local teams to act in all this variation, right? Because you think, how many different new retail models evolved as an output of COVID? It wasn't one. It's a whole bunch of them. Every retailer did their own experiment on how to handle it. So there wasn't one way to analyze it. And then, of course, unfortunately, the spread of COVID has been very different around the world. We've seen lockdowns and opening up and more lockdowns and all this variation, right? So you could never handle that in a centralized way, not fast enough, not at scale, right? But if you have local teams who understand the domain problem, the context of that retailer and that environment, if you can empower them, well, you got a fighting chance.
However, this does precipitate another problem, and that is the people who are using these tools. That's a pretty substantial responsibility. I can think of a couple of things. One, just from the engineering side, you have to be open to this very foreign idea of allowing access to data, potentially allowing ingestion of data through channels that on the surface of it, it looks like you may not have any control over. Now, obviously, there are ways to address those problems. By extension, the people who are doing that ingesting and doing the data analytics, they do have a lot of newfound power. How do they know what they're able to do, especially if they're coming out of an organization or already in an organization that is kind of stuck in an old way that does want to make this transformation?
Yeah, well, so I mean, it's a really good point, right? So some of our biggest customers are healthcare companies, insurance providers, right? And, you know, kind of their data and privacy, it's a big deal to them, right? So you have to have a privacy security horizontal layer that goes across all of these independent teams. It's back to the kind of vertical and horizontal model. you can't ignore that, right? That's critical. And you have to have standards and, you know, kind of capabilities that go with that, right? But then if within that you have resources embedded in the teams who are empowered, you know, you can make those two things work together. But it's not a trivial problem. I would just say the alternative is, guess what? They're going to get a hold of the data. They're going to put it in Excel and they're going to do their own thing. I mean, that you know, I was talking to Tom Davenport yesterday and what he said is that cow is out of the barn, right? And you're never putting that cow back in the barn.
This is, again, back to this recurring theme of transformation and transition. You're talking about going from a pre-planned kind of engineering-based world where everything is deterministic and known up front. So let's call that an engineering metaphor, to this evolutionary metaphor where it's distributed and things are changing on the edge all the time in real time.
So what's important for me is this is not to get rid of the engineering skills or mindset, right? Because first of all, there's a ton of complexity here. And, you know, your engineers have those skills, right? They understand how to deal with complexity. They understand how to test results and make sure that you have accuracy, et cetera. So what I'm not saying is you get rid of your engineering capabilities. I'm saying you embed them in the teams that are these cross-functional, call them product teams, that are focused on outcomes, right? So they may still belong to, report up to a central analytics function, but they're responsible to and embedded in these cross-functional business teams. That's kind of how I think of it. Now, there is a big change in mindset, right? So, you know, kind of this engineering approach, well, you know, they're used to very controlled, structured approaches and discipline, which take time. And a business team is focused on, I got to do something now, right? And, you know, I'm going to do the best thing I can now, but, you know, kind of the store is going to either be stocked with goods tomorrow or it's not, right? You know, there's, I can't ever get tomorrow back, right? So I think when you put the teams together and you empower them, that they actually can figure this out, you know, kind of together, right? If you put the engineering skills with the business people in these cross-functional groups, you know, they'll get the balance right. You have to empower them, you have to train them, you know, and it's a culture change to move. It's kind of like in IT, you know, in software development, we went from the big waterfall approach to building software to an agile approach, right? And if you were used to the big waterfall approach, you know, used to, I'm going to go define requirements, I'm going to get the requirements validated, I'm going to build the first piece, and I'm going to put together a second piece and the third piece, and then I'm going to go test it. And like, and a year later, I'm going to deliver something, right? And in an agile world where you're saying, I'm going to do a sprint, and that sprint is going to be 2 weeks, and, you know, I'm going to iterate, it's a very different culture change. I think it's that same approach that we need to apply to analytics and to these cross-functional teams. But it's the same mindset change that the software engineers had to go through to go from waterfall to agile. It's not an obvious transition, but when they get there, they actually like it. That's my experience.
I want to come back to the need for engineers, because I think that that is a really important point that you're making. In the meantime, I'm thinking about, when you're describing this, I'm thinking about engineers embedded in product teams and how that represents an opportunity where you have this hybrid approach where you do have centralized analytical capabilities. You also have distributed analytical capabilities. And so it would be advantageous if those things could make their way back into a central organization and be reused. So how can you even begin to think about accomplishing something like that in an organization, especially a large organization?
Yeah, so that's a really key thing, right? So we used to think of data architecture as the central function, right? And it was the data architect was part of the data warehouse team in a lot of cases, and designed the data model, which included both the incoming data and how the calculations all worked, right? And it was all over there, right? now data architecture almost becomes this act of reviewing and correlating the best ideas that come from these different sources that are being developed out on the edge, and creating a catalog where then they're reused by others, right? So I think you made a contrast between an engineering and organic view. And I love that. And that's an analogy I use a lot, because I think in this organic world, things are evolving in the edge, as you refer to it, right? But we need the things that evolve in the edge. We need the best of those ideas to become standards. We need them to win the competitive battle of evolution, right? And I think the data architecture function really becomes the function to help catalog and pull those things out and, you know, create standards from them, but not from the perspective of, I'm going to go build the standards and then I'm going to give them to you, but I'm going to work with you and I'm going to watch all these teams. And as this work happens, we're going to, you know, we're going to evolve those standards back into this central reusable place.
Yeah, you used the term organic there, organic versus engineering. And I think you also meant structured there. So, and now you're moving to a world where engineers get to use and exercise more creativity. And that, I think, has downstream consequences. I mean, as we're able to use technology to make our lives easier and to eliminate routine functions, it frees up people to be more creative. So are you actually seeing that happening in organizations?
Yeah, totally. And I think it ties to this product idea, right? So, you know, kind of your point is, I think, a really important one. In the old engineering world, we actually were only using half the brain of the engineer, right? We were telling them what to do, and then they had to go do it, right? But they didn't get to think. It's like, here's the requirements, go build X, right? But when you put them in these cross-functional teams, and they're part of the group that's both thinking about the outcome and building the outcome, we're now lighting up both sides of their brain, right? So we're giving the ability to help do it, but they're actually part of the process of defining the answer. And I think that's one of the reasons why engineers oftentimes feel so empowered by this. And look, I'll go back to my example of Amazon. You know, I'd use the example of a bunch of other customers we're working with. Their engineers are embedded in these teams. They don't think of themselves as part of some central group anymore. And, you know, they don't even really think about the fact that they're helping evolve the answer, right? So I had a customer a few months ago that I was talking to, big insurance company. And one of the things that we had built into our product was the ability to let users ingest data themselves into the data platform, right? And our product team had trialed that out with their group, and they loved it, right? And then I was talking to the head analytics. He's like, yeah, this is great. We can, you know, all these users, we give them their own like workspace. They get to ingest their own data and do these things with it because they're experimenting. And I thought, you know, insurance, you think insurance is like this big, slow-moving world, right? You know, I come from the world of central data warehousing. That's where I developed a lot of my career. I got to tell you, in a million years, we would never let an end user ingest their own data into the data warehouse. Like, you know, never, ever would that happen, right? But that's what's going on, right? These teams are being empowered. They are doing this. This is really happening across industry, I think, at scale. But we haven't actually communicated a model for this, right? Which is why I think it's so important to, you know, really get our arms around this definition of collaborative analytics and take it away from, you know, kind of all the, you go out and read all the literature about, you know, about this, you find the traditional data warehouse stuff. We need to talk about it in this new way.
What you said about ingesting your own data, how your customer described it as setting up their own workspace. I think about that from a software engineering perspective, and I think, well, that actually makes sense. You can do things to isolate data, to isolate your core data from a user's workspace. And that's no big deal because data is so cheap now. And even computing is so cheap to handle that data. Is that the driving innovation there, or is there something else going on? Are people just now ready for it?
Well, so there is a huge innovation, right? Because data warehousing, you know, historically, if you buy the data warehouse hardware, right? and you're limited. Your capacity, first of all, you spent a lot of money on it. And second of all, your capacity is now limited, right? But the cloud, which is both cheap and hyper scalable and elastic, is an enormous enabler to this, right? Because even if you had wanted to enable people to put their own data in the data warehouse back in the old day, if you didn't account for that and kind of almost know how much data was going to get ingested, you wouldn't get the hardware right, right? Or you'd buy too much or too little, and it's a very expensive process, right? In this hyper-elastic world, very scalable world, you know, it can scale up and down on demand, right? And that innovation is really key to allowing this empowerment that is going on.
Yeah, I'm thinking about all the holdouts for legitimate reasons, but all the holdouts who have taken so long to move from on-prem to the cloud.
You know, it's one of the things that we talk about with clients. You think, okay, so maybe you've got a big central data warehouse implementation that you've built over years. And look, it does a lot of stuff, right? But you're not going to be able to do this kind of empowerment in that environment. You need something like a Snowflake or Redshift, or, you know, that really can scale from really small workloads to really big workloads and do that really efficiently. And there is just no way to do that on-prem. It can't happen.
Let's talk about another impediment. I want to go back to the engineers, specifically the availability of engineers and how this has been or was projected to be a significant problem. So in our intro call, you mentioned a study from IBM that said something to the effect of, by the year 2020, we would need 2 million data scientists in the US, but we only produce 40,000 per year. And so, you know, realistically, you might be able to scale that up to some, you know, maybe 100,000, but 2 million is an order of magnitude beyond that. So how has that been a factor in driving this?
Yeah. So, you know, so you hear a lot about the citizen data scientist, right? And empowering end users. And I think it kind of goes at this point, right? So, you know, I think that study, you quoted the numbers exactly right. There's no way we're going to go from 40,000 to 2 million. It ain't going to happen, right? Let's train all the people we can. But the fact is that we've got combined teams of business people who are semi-technical, end users who are not at all technical, and engineers who are very technical, and we need them to all work together. Our view of that is, under the hood, we need the ability to write language, engineering language, because, you know, nobody's going to be more efficient than an engineer writing a specific piece of code in SQL or Python or whatever to do a job. But we want to also empower business users with low code or no code capabilities that can inhabit that same environment, right? So for us, actually, this is the core of what we're trying to do at Agenity, is to make these things seamless, right? An engineer wants to write a script to do something, fine. Let's make it reusable, parameterized, so somebody else can use it. We want an end user to be able to use a wizard to do something also that's pretty darn efficient by themselves. Yeah, we can do that. If that wizard produces a piece of code that's similar to the code that the engineer wrote, we can now make these things work together. However, whether we pull that off or not, the fact is that you've got to recognize that, you know, for these empowered teams to work, everybody on those teams is not going to have engineering skills, right? You know, there are only so many people who went to, to school and learned software engineering, et cetera. You're not going to have everybody have those skills. You're going to have some, you know, medium skilled, semi-technical resources. A lot of them, a lot of business analysts are, you know, what I would call semi-technical, right? Really good data skills. They really understand the domain of the business, but, you know, they don't necessarily write the most efficient code, right? I had a customer tell me recently, we were talking about this, and it's a big healthcare company. And he said, you know, we got all these users. It turns out during the day, the major workload on our data warehouse, which was a big Teradata data warehouse back to the centralized, the major thing is users writing their own queries. And I have a group of DBAs who spent part of their day killing bad queries, right? That are like out of control, right? There is no way for those two groups to work together. So their way of working together, user submits a query, DBA kills a query. That just doesn't sound all that efficient, right?
I really like stories like this because I feel like it's an uplifting side of change, putting people out or displacing people. So we know that technology eliminates routine and increasingly more and more complex tasks, but we've already talked about how that frees up people to do what people are best at, and that is being creative. And I actually see the market response in building tools as part of that process, because what you've just laid out is that at the same time that data access and data analytics is getting democratized throughout the organization, and there is a shortage of data scientists, the data scientists who do exist have a more fulfilling and more important role to play in this, and that they have to actually step up and do more in terms of creating more value and getting that value out there. So I think that when we talked last time, you described that as being a multiplier of the rest of the business, or can you touch on that a little bit?
You know, I think when they are embedded, right, they do kind of force multiply because they're now working with these business people who are doing part of the work. I also think, you know, that a lot of people got AI wrong, right? They said, we're going to have an AI group, a priesthood of AI people who are going to go out and solve all these problems, right? And they don't have the business context. I mean, they might have great machine learning capabilities. They really understand AI. I've worked with a lot of these folks and they're really good. You need to put them with the business people who have the understanding of the context, right? Because a model that isn't delivered to a problem at the point that the problem needs to be solved, you know, it's just an intellectual exercise, right? I think the only way we're going to make advanced analytics really useful is when we put these, you know, people together, right? And by the way, I also think, you know, kind of, there's not a, like an AI project versus a BI project, right? You know, it's not reporting or AI. It's always all the above. Like most of the problems that I see have some combination of some operational data thing. I got to feed in a result to some end user and some reporting capability and some modeled capability. And all those things together are part of solving these problems, right? So, you know, you think of the cross-functional discipline, you need to do that. This productized structure is the way to do it. And when you embed those people in the teams, I think that they are multiplied in terms of their capability.
AI is really just another client to the data or just another consumer of the data that would do something just the same as a human would.
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of oftentimes it's feeding you know, kind of an analytic to a human, right? So, you know, I mean, I don't know about this whole, are machines going to take over the world or not? You know, is it a kumbaya moment or a, you know, a Terminator moment? But I tend to, you know, think in terms of analytics as an empowerment, right? I'm much more in that side of the world, and that I think that a lot of times it's the recommendation to a human that is really valuable, right? At the end of the day, this isn't going to eliminate people. I mean, very little AI is really doing kind of full-on deep cognitive stuff, right? It's mostly doing explorations of data and producing a very defined output to a problem, right? So I think we're a long ways from the machines taking over. I think AI is a recommendation engine to people as an empowerment is much more likely. And, you know, it's a place where we can all feel better about that as a direction.
When you're talking about the engineers and the data scientists who do exist in the organization and their role becoming that of a force multiplier for the business users in an organization, do you see that as solving the same problem of data literacy and understanding what is and isn't possible? Or is that another problem altogether?
Well, I think they're related problems. I think you do have to teach data literacy broadly in an organization. You know, I almost think that data literacy should be part of the educational curriculum of our schools, right? And I think in an interesting way, it actually is. You know, kind of. I was having a conversation with my brother not long ago, and my niece came on the call, and you know, she's a senior in high school, and not a nerd, a techie at all, right? Much more interested in social kind of activities, right? And she started talking about her stats class and how cool it was. And I thought, okay, well, this is great because in my generation, the only people who were interested in stats were the real techie types, right? And even they didn't really like it. Me, we didn't really love it, right? But data is so useful now that even somebody who's much more interested in social change type activities, you know, sees the power of data, right? But I think data literacy is critical for everybody. I think that's kind of a base thing that we can get at and get broadly skilled. You know, there's a difference between training people in data literacy and teaching, you know, people to be data scientists. And I think you need to do both.
Right. I think of those two things, data scientists versus data literacy, one about being how and the other about being why, what, and the outcome. So it makes a lot of sense to me that if somebody is interested in whatever it may be, whether it's, you know, some sort of, if you're a consumer, in the case of your niece, you have social interests, or in the case of somebody who's running a social organization, for example, you have things that you want to accomplish. And once you understand that it's possible to answer questions, it's almost like it's no different than going to Google now, right? I remember when Google really first came on the scene, and I don't remember what it was like before to try to answer questions. I remember as a kid reading encyclopedias, but now I can't imagine not going straight to Google for an answer. And in a business, things are more complicated. Things are more specific. The data isn't in a general Google database, so to speak. It makes sense to me that that's what we're seeing happening to the workforce. I think of it as being part of this digitally native workforce coming in.
Right. Yeah. The kids they're just becoming more digital. They're more digitally native. They're just being brought up that way. Right. But I think we do need to make this data literacy key to everything we do. Digital literacy maybe is the better word that I think you're kind of hinting at.
How do we upskill, reskill? How do we facilitate arguably the greatest knowledge transfer in the history of the human workforce?
Yeah, that's so I don't think I have an answer for that. I think I go back to my kind of empowerment, putting, you know, cross-functional teams together. I think some data literacy training can be, you know, foundational. And I don't think it's that hard to do. I think that, you know, the thing that we sometimes get caught up on when we think of transformation is like a big thing, right? But sometimes you can boil it down to something very simple, outcomes, right? Like, so, you know, kind of, I was talking to a healthcare company recently, and he was talking about how long their members stuck around. And it suddenly dawned on me that, in fact, their business was a subscription business, right? And like, you know, I didn't ever really understand that before, right? And so you're like, okay, renewal rate. Okay, I know how to think about renewal rates, right? You know, so, you know, I think sometimes you just get down to like, look, our outcome is to increase our renewal rate by X percent. And, you know, now we've got something to focus on. And I think, you know, kind of it's having those kind of things that we can boil things down to that are achievable, measurable, as opposed to like the meta world of transformation, which can be this overarching, difficult to define concept.
You know, we have normalcy bias, we have, and of course, confirmation bias as well, but we have these ideas about how things should work. And most businesses are relatively the same, especially within the same industry. So do you think we may reach a point where, let's say 10, 20, 30 years from now, that a lot of the metrics that we're now having to put a lot of thought into coming up with, those things are just standard in a business and you wouldn't need to apply the same amount of mental effort?
Well, I think that they are becoming, you know, metrics are becoming standard to business for sure. And I think you're hinting at something else, which I've seen, which is this, you know, kind of how we ran businesses before. We promoted people to senior roles because they were really good about those roles and they understood the business, right? And, you know, we have this term decision maker, right? So, you know, senior executives were decision makers, right? Well, that implies that everything's coming to them to make a decision, right? In this empowered culture, right, there are no central decision makers, right? There are a bunch of empowered autonomous teams, right, who are have outcome objectives. So we set the objective more centrally, but I think that the decision process becomes more local to this autonomous team. That's a big change. And I think a lot of my generation, you know, has struggled with that change because, you know, we got to our senior places because we were good at whatever we did. Maybe I wasn't, but somebody was, and they got there and they expect to make the decisions, right? And I had a CEO I was working with that wanted to make a bunch of decisions, and I was trying to introduce this model. I'm like, well, no, you actually don't get to make this decision, right? What you have to do is set the objective, and then the team will drive to it. And I got to tell you, that wasn't an easy, an easy thing to convince him of.
I would say that that probably represents one of many of the behavioral challenges that we see in digital transformation. It's never about technology. It's about the behavioral changes that need to take place. And so what I wonder is all of the things that we've talked about, like this idea of moving to a more agile working ability. And, you know, clearly it happened in the software world, but arguably engineers are engineering minded. I kind of wonder, based on what you're telling me, is it realistic to think about an entire workforce being reskilled as some level of proficiency? At a minimum, people will be digitally native. They'll be used to using certain tools, but some level of proficiency in being able to actually come up with these metrics themselves. Do we need to get to that point?
Well, I think it's less about the metric and more about, let's call it a product-centric model. What does that mean? So for me, it means outcome-focused. It means empowered and cross-functional. And then it means hypothesis-driven, right? So, you know, this idea that is kind of coming out of science of I'm going to form a hypothesis, then I'm going to test that hypothesis, that becomes really kind of, I think, the key to both analytics success, which, of course, if you're going to test a hypothesis, that's analytics, but and to transformation as a whole, right? That we need to get people to think about a hypothesis-driven approach to change. And when you say there is no such thing as a requirement, it's something I say to my team sometimes, there's no such thing as a requirement, only a hypothesis. Now when you put the word hypothesis out there, you're immediately, well, how do I validate that? How do I test that, right? How do I prove that that's right? And then that becomes a foundation of, well, I got to iterate. I got to be able to test it as fast as possible so I'm not off on some tangent, right? And, you know, the big engineered world, not engineered world in the bad sense, but in the top-down long sense, is we made a decision about what we were going to do without ever having tested our hypothesis, right? We just went and did it. We spent weeks or months at it, right? The key bit to me is going to this hypothesis-oriented approach. I think we do have to teach that. I don't think it's necessarily obvious to a lot of people because sometimes the idea is what drives them, not the hypothesis or the outcome. You know, so, you know, kind of every idea is really about an outcome, but a lot of innovators get focused on the idea, not the outcome. And, you know, the idea is just a hypothesis for how you can drive an outcome, right? And we still have in popular culture, you know, we have these views of, you know, the Steve Jobs of the world that are going to come up with the great idea and, you know, they're going to define it. Well, actually, if you really look at what Apple did, it was much more of a hypothesis-driven, you know, iteration approach.
Given everything that we've talked about here, we've covered so much ground, what would be the key takeaway that you feel like people out there in an organization, in leadership roles that can do something about this, what do you feel like they need to take away from this to take the next step?
Focus on outcomes, empower teams around your most important outcomes, put cross-functional groups together focused on those outcomes with as few dependencies outside of their team as possible, and then put your best people in those teams, not in some centralized group, and then think of your centralized group as a support function that's providing resources, capabilities, training, tools to those teams. To me, that's the model of the future. And I don't think it's just the future. I think these digital first companies, that is where they are.
Yeah. And that's really coming down to being more competitive.
Yeah, for sure.
If somebody wants to get in touch with Agenity or you, what is the best way for them to do that?
Agenity.com is our website, right? You know, so we have kind of a freemium product model. Go check it out. Download it. If you like it, use it. If you really like it, we hope you'll pay for it. You know, kind of upgrade from there. I'm also available on LinkedIn. You know, look, I'm always trying to offer people advice and help, right? So if you, you know, if I can be of use to you, feel free to reach out. You know, a lot of people have helped me along the way, and, you know, I'd love to do that for others.
All right. Thank you so much, Rick.
Thanks, Chad.